Our next speaker is Chris Niskanen. He comes to us directly from the communications hot seat. He is the communications director at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Prior to his work at DNR, he was the outdoors editor for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. When we come to talking about hooks, if we think back to Jim's presentation, I noted in his biography, you all have these in your materials, that his current hobby is helping to excavate a 17th century Eskimo village in Alaska. That's a hook. Right. So his presentation is Making the Invisible Visible, Telling Stories About Science. Chris.
Let's see. Can everybody hear me okay? All right, thanks a lot. Is Brian Stenquist in here? Oh, I see him in the back. He's got a plate full of food. I have to rightfully give him credit for the phrase, making the invisible visible. That was a phrase that he coined. I don't know if he got that from somebody else, but there it is. It's a great phrase. I think it's a great thing for scientists like yourself to think about how to tell stories about things that people can't see, things that are not part of what's in front of them every day, like traffic, which I had an interesting experience with this morning. So who is checking their Twitter feed this morning? Raise your hand. Oh, pretty light usage here. All right. Who's checked their Facebook account in the last 24 hours? Raise their hands. Okay, yeah, that's tells you a little bit about who's using Twitter, who's using Facebook. Who has an Instagram account in here? Wow. I will note that most of the people with an Instagram account, this is an unscientific study, just simple an observation, you look considerably younger than the people who have Facebook accounts. Am I right about that? Who tweeted this morning that they were going to wear wool socks to the office? Let's file that under useless information that I put out on the on social media, but yes, I did. And nobody has liked it yet, so go figure. So I had an interesting conversation. I live in Stillwater, Minnesota. Might be maybe the home to the most antique stores in Minnesota. Anybody here been to Stillwater? Anybody live in Stillwater? Got a couple people who live in Stillwater here? Fantastic. So I was in an antique store the other day, and it didn't look like things were going very well. There wasn't a lot of people in the store, a lot of sour faces of the people sitting behind the counters, and so I started talking to one of the owners. And I said, what's going on? I said, this used to be a really thriving business. She says, people don't want this crap anymore. I'm like, what do you mean? She said, all these baby boomers are getting rid of all their stuff. And I have all this beautiful furniture in here, all this beautiful Victorian stuff, all these beautiful hardwood tables, all these beautiful hutches and signs and glassware. Nobody wants this crap anymore. People are overwhelmed with their parents' stuff. How many people are experiencing this right now? Yeah. How many people have read the book by Marie Kondo? This is this Japanese woman who's come up with this theory that you need to just pare your life down. You got to just get rid of stuff. So what's happening in Stillwater is that all these antique stores got to come up with a new business model, or they're going out of business. And keep your eye out if you're looking for some storefront space and you want to start a new career. There's going to be some opening up in Stillwater. I don't recommend you selling Victorian furniture or anything older than 1982. Maybe you could go back to 1970, but people don't want all this crap anymore. The same problem that we are all facing, overwhelmed with stuff, is happening in our communications world. I mean, we are inundated with messages, social media, you know, millions of TV channels to pick from, YouTube. I mean, kids don't watch TV anymore, they watch YouTube. How many people have kids who just get their information from YouTube? It's pretty common. How many people have their own YouTube channel here? Oh, there's a couple of folks, yeah. We're overwhelmed with information. We're overwhelmed with information, and people are having a hard time curating information. And that's the word I want to talk a little bit about. Curating information and storytelling are the two things that I'm really interested in right now, and I'm going to share with you some of the things that I've been thinking about and things that I've been talking to with my staff at the DNR. So we're overwhelmed with information, yet on my Instagram account, the sister of one of my neighbors has an account called The Hypnotist Collector. And she sells vintage clothing. And I don't know why I follow this person, because I did buy this vest at Goodwill, but I'm not going to buy anything from her, from the hypnotist collector. But I'm fascinated by how she is curating her clothing and the story that she tells behind every piece that she puts up. And no sooner than she puts up some really interesting shawl that somebody handcrafted in 1972, she puts on there sold. So I've been thinking about what's the juju that she's got going on here. One, she understands what her marketplace is like. She's not selling oak tables on Instagram. She's curating and selling things that people really want. She's selling really interesting clothing that has a story behind it. And part of, I think, our job as communicators now is to start thinking more about how we get through the clutter. How do we Marie Kondo our communication strategies? And also how we do a better job of curating our information as a government agency and put it out there in places that people want to see it. Now, one of the things that the DNR does really well is that we interact with the media a lot. We get like 3,000 media contacts a year. That's for a state agency, that's just off the charts. That's like 6 to 12 media contacts a day. So one of the things we're really aware of is the media still has a real active presence in Minnesota, and people are really interested in what's going on in the media. We have one of the highest per capita subscription rates to newspapers, whether it's online or you get it in front of your door, of any other state. We also have the highest, I think next to New Hampshire, highest voting per capita rate. There's a relationship there, I think. So we're really interested in interacting with the media, but they're just a conduit for information. I mean, they're just a delivery system. And they filter it in a way that is problematic for us sometimes, because many of the things that we talk about at the agency are complex science-y types of things. And one of the things that we're always in a continuous improvement project around is how do we better explain science to our media and to our readers. The other part of that is how do we curate our information and tell better stories, not just through news releases, but visually and on our social media channels. And that is a really big job. And I'm beginning to think that we're working too hard at it. That maybe maybe the story needs to be a little shorter, and maybe the story needs to be a little more to the point, and maybe we don't have to provide everybody with all the data that we think that they need to have. So everybody in this room sort of lives by data, and data is a really important part of how we make scientific decisions. But we don't have to, people have to trust that you've got the data, and we all have the data, but we're not going to communicate about the data. We're going to communicate about what this particular thing is going to change somebody's life. We want to be kind of the hypnotist collectors of social media. We want to curate this information and put it out there in a way that people don't have to think too hard about it, but it leaves them with an impression. It leaves them with a feeling about, hey, the DNR kind of has this covered. You know, that I trust the DNR. There hasn't been a lot of, it's hard, one of the things we talk about at the DNR is we're a trusted source of information. I don't have any good data to say that X number of Minnesotans trust the data that we put out or the information that we put out. There have been a couple of surveys that I've had access to. I think the Nature Conservancy did one here a few years ago. I saw some of the data a friend shared with me, and that the DNR has a really high trust rate among people who, you know, when they get their information, they trust us. So we want to build that trust, but then we also want to keep building on this idea that we have an important story to tell, but to do it simply without having to overwhelm people with data. I was giving this similar talk a while back to some of the folks in our Eco Water section, and someone said, well, data's all important. We need to give people more data. I'm overwhelmed by data. I mean, I am just simply overwhelmed by data. I shot a deer this weekend, and I took the spleen out and sent it to the DNR. I'm a participant in a neo-NICS study, which is really interesting to me. And so I'm reading the instructions on how to remove the spleen from my deer, and I'm thinking, dang it, there needs to be a YouTube video on this. I'm standing there over this dead deer, and I'm like, okay, that's the liver, that's the heart, and the spleen is connected to the rumen, and so I think I got the right organ. And then I packaged it all up, and I put it in a, I want to talk to one of our researchers who put this together. He probably has no idea that I'm participating, but I want to help him and her how to sort of better communicate how to remove a spleen from a deer. I'm really interested in that. How do we get people really interested in things like that? I put it in UPS today. Hopefully, when they open it up, they're like, no, that's not the right organ. Come on, Niskanen, what are you doing? So how do you tell good stories? How do you make the visible invisible visible? That is a really hard thing to do. When I worked as a reporter, one of the things that my editors would always say is, why do people care about this? You know, if you cover a beat, you get really passionate about the topic that you're covering, and I'd go to have a story, and I'd take it to my editor, and he'd go, are you kidding me? Nobody cares about that. And I'm like, well, it's really interesting. I would have pitched him the neo-NICS story, by the way. Actually, that story about this science that we're doing has been in the media quite a bit. How would I have written that story as a reporter? I would have participated in it, and I would have talked about my struggles in trying to find the spleen. But I would have tried to make it kind of funny. I would have tried to sort of make what I was doing as a participatory reporter interesting to people. And what I just did is I told you about my story of trying to remove the spleen, and people sort of laughed at it. But what was interesting about it was it was real. As I was telling the story, I was getting the spleen out. I was painting a picture of what it was like to participating. So our challenge as government communicators is to paint a picture, tell the story, and really get things down to the bare essentials that people care about. You have to break through all of the other hutches and oak tables and everything else that clutter people's lives and really deliver the goods. Governor Dayton did a plain language executive order and back when he was governor, and he and his staff really did a good job of summarizing what plain language was. And it was putting information in formats and in language that's commonly understood by the public. I mean, that's just the minimum. If you can't put it in language that's commonly understood by the public, you're in big trouble. My neighbor's calling me right now to tell me about the deer that he just shot. I carry two cell phones, one for work, one for an office. Talk about being overwhelmed by information. So anyway, how do you get to telling good stories? I think telling stories yourself, thinking about how people understand information, making it relevant to them, making it getting to the point real quick, talking about why this is important, and always make sure that there are visuals associated with it. People are becoming much more visual oriented. Instagram is largely a social media tool that really appeals to people's, you know, things that they like to see. That's what makes it nice and efficient. I tell a story about when I was picking up my wife from the airport once, and she had been in France with her mother on a vacation for 2 weeks, and I was left home with the children to take care of a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I had a list, and I had all these things that I was going to do. I was not only going to take care of the kids, but I was going to clean the house, and I was going to mow the lawn. I was going to do all these things. And so I had a plan, and everything went well. Nobody went to the hospital. The kids, had a fun time, and I was successful as a father and as a husband. And when my wife got off the plane, I met her at Gate A over there at the airport, and I was really excited to tell her, I mean, how good I was. You know. Guess what I got accomplished, you know? Even got the lawnmower tuned up. And so, I mean, I was actually really accomplished. I was super excited. I mean, the fact that nobody went to the hospital and nobody got sick and, you know, everybody had all their limbs and stuff like that. As a parent, I felt like I was doing a pretty good job. She got in the car, and I was, being an extrovert, I was just like, gonna go ta-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I started in, and I started saying, well, you know, how was your trip, da-da-da-da. And she, you know, being an introvert, was, you know, kind of quiet. She was tired. And I started talking about all these things that had happened. And I instantly saw this sort of dark cloud come over her. Anybody communicate with their spouse and have seen the dark cloud? Or you're like, God, I'm in deep trouble here and I don't know why. What did I just say? You can just see it. It's just like it's a cloud going across the sun, and then all of a sudden you're like, you kind of freeze like a deer in the headlights. And so... there was a long pause, and I realized I'd made the mistake. I'd made a huge mistake. I had not curated my information properly. In fact, I was so unaware of my audience that I had made the biggest mistake in communications. I didn't understand what my audience really wanted, nor had I curated my information really well. Anybody know what was the first question that she wanted answered? How are the kids? Are they alive? Exactly. Exactly. So I backed the car. I backed my communications plan up. Beep, 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 and got it reset in my mind. And I said, hey, the kids are great. And I hope that your mom had a great time. And then the cloud went away, and it got sunny again. And she says, well, tell me about the kids. And all right. And so then I quickly got to the point about what the kids had done and who they played with and, you know, that they ate well and all the things that she cared about, things that were really important to her. And I asked her a couple more questions about her mom, which was really important. So I, after making a big mistake and not knowing my audience and not curating my information very well, I was able to get out of the doghouse. So getting back to, you know, the telling the story of making the invisible visible is really difficult. It's knowing your audience. It's keeping the data away. I mean, you got to just throw the data out the door. Tell people why this is important to them in a succinct way. Why does it matter? Why do people care about groundwater? I mean, that's a big question. I mean, that's one that everybody in this room cares about. I don't have the answer, but we can talk about it. And also, how do you tell the story in which you put the most important information first? In journalism, it's called the inverted pyramid style. You put the most important information first, and then you go down into kind of supporting things, you know, the things that support that. And it's to tell a story that resonates with people. It's the curation, it's the hypnotist collector way of putting things in front of people that you might not ever be interested in. I might not ever buy an alpaca poncho. But for some reason, Angie has my interest in that alpaca poncho. I don't know, maybe I just have weird things that I like to look at on Instagram. So anyway, with that, I wanna ask, see if you guys have any questions. Because I know this is an extroverted audience of people who like to raise their hands and ask questions.
You mentioned that DNR.
Oh, there we go, hi.
Bob Tammer from Sudan.
Hey,
you
Bob.
Mentioned that DNR has a high trust rate, and I think deservedly so for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you are charged with regulating mining, and you're charged with promoting mining.
Yep.
Now, I remember from my catechism that no man can serve two masters, but now you've got a woman in charge, so my question would be, can Sarah Strauman serve two masters in this particular case? Thank you.
Well, she's my boss. Of course she can. You know, that's a great question because people see this as a contradiction. How can you regulate mining and promote mining at the same time? I don't have Sarah's talking points with me, but I know she's answered this question quite a bit. My job as a communications manager, communications director, is to sort of be able to unpack that for people. My answer is why not? I mean, we have two departments who work in the same building, and when it comes to doing a mining project, I want those people talking to each other. I mean, if a mining project comes in the door, I want Lands and Minerals to be looking at it through the lens of what, you know, how can this project meet state standards? And on the other hand, I want the environmental review people talking to the mining people about how does this project meet state standards? That's what it's all about. I mean, we have some of the strongest environmental protections of any state in the country. We have, Minnesotans care about the environment. When it comes to working on projects like this, I want the people who are the smartest and the most experienced to be able to look at a project like this and see how it makes sense and how it will meet state standards. And that those people are working to ensure that the process has good public input, follows all the state standards for transparency, that we are curating our information in a way that makes it transparent and visible to people, and that we can show that we are working not only within our organization, but with our other partners, like an MPCA, or the U.S. Forest Service, or the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I think that's probably a short version of the answer that Sarah gives, but having been from the outside, working in the private sector, and then working for the DNR, I had that same skepticism. Having seen it in person and having worked with people, I'm totally confident that this works in an extremely good way. And the proof of the pudding is, does the legislature think that we're doing a good job of that? And if they didn't, they would have split these two areas up a long time ago. We have some really smart legislators who are involved in these projects, and they think that this is a good way to go. Any more questions? Yeah.
Chris, when I was in grad school 35, 40 years ago, a journal that I read on a regular basis, one issue, they published papers that had been printed 100 years before then. And these papers were long, they were elegant, they were interesting, they captured my attention. These days, we're talking about factoids, talking points, get the message across quickly. Is there still room for long, well-written articles for those of us that
in
are
the,
willing to
in,
take
in
the time?
In the journalism world?
Any world, any part of our world.
In my department, we have the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer Magazine. An average article in there is 1,200 to 1,800 words. Our subscriptions now. This is the magazine. It's the most read magazine in Minnesota. Our subscriptions are going up like they've never had before. People are really interested in our magazine. We adopted a new marketing strategy, which is why our subscriptions are going up. So yeah, there's still a place for that. One of the challenges we have right now is, and we're doing a reader survey, but we think that our readers are going to come back and they're going to be a lot like you. They're going to be white, they're going to be in their 60s, 50s, 60s, and if we want to have a successful business model, we need to start making sure that our readers look like Minnesotans. And that's a big challenge. One of the things that the editor recently did is he put together a panel of a diverse panel of experts, journalists, people who are in the public relations world, and they were they're Asian American, they're Korean American, Latino, Latina, all kinds of people to help us sort of look at the magazine through a different lens. And it's been really fascinating, really fascinating. So I think there is room for that, but I think that people want those articles to probably look a little differently than they used to and have a much different audience in them.
Okay, so I think we've got time for one more.
Okay, great. Sure.
Thank you. Excuse me. One of the historical perspectives, because I started at DNR in like 81 or 82, and my memory, recollection was during the 80s, what DNR said was taken as the truth, or it's true. If Joe Alexander made a pronouncement, it happened. But starting in, I would say, the early 90s, and since then, as I left, at least in the program I was in, every action was questioned. And it happened, I think, in part because of the available information. You know, they could go online or find a contradicting expert, and DNR was not expert. And in general, in your publications, I think you will find that people appreciate the information. But do you have any insights for folks here, not just DNR, other agencies, or consultants that on a one-to-one communication, how do you build the trust and get the information to people and have them believe you as opposed to the expert online who has an opposing opinion?
One of the things that my commissioner says, and I really believe this is true, is we need to look at not who's at the table, but who's not at the table. Who's not at the table right now in discussions? Is it veterans? Is it women? Is it the Somali American community? Is it a rural farmer who's never been to one of our public meetings? Is it the mayor of Duluth? So I think the way to build trust is to get people in our circle of influence who haven't been in that circle. And you're going to see a lot more from the Walz administration and a lot more from the DNR on how we're going to go deeper in our citizen engagement to try to get people who have not been in those conversations in the past. Because sometimes we hear from the same voices over and over again, and we start to believe, well, that's the truth about how people feel. Well, that's not necessarily the truth of how people feel. There's a lot of people who have, who might support the decisions that we make, but they've never been given the opportunity to voice that. Or there are people who have not had a chance to really be invited to the table. So that was, the diversity panel that we have with the magazine is really trying to get at that. So I think the key to that conversation is to reach out to more people. And as a chief communications officer of the DNR, I'm not afraid of different opinions. I think that's great. Opinions that aren't rooted in fact or, those things are kind of difficult, but, we need to get the room bigger. We need to get more people involved in that conversation. And that's what the commissioner intends to do, and she's doing a great job of it.